This podcast is brought to you by NerdWallet. Are you paying for your me time with just any credit card in your wallet? While you shouldn't stop treating yourself, you should start paying with a credit card that has perks. NerdWallet lets you compare top travel credit cards side by side to maximize your spending, some even offering 10 times points on your spending. So what could future you do with better rewards? A free flight? Room upgrades? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Hey everyone, it's Katie Couric, and I want to tell you about one of my new favorite podcasts. It's called A Really Good Cry with the amazing Roddy Devlukia, a plant-based chef, entrepreneur, and now a podcast host who will guide you through a journey of self-discovery, one tear at a time. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Roddy Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hi, everyone. I'm Katie Couric, and this is Next Question. I love when the people we've gotten to know over the years on the big and small screen come out with a memoir. And I'm not just saying that because I did the same last year, going there now available in paperback. No, I'm talking about people we feel like we know, but don't really know, you know? Like the actor and activist Gina Davis. Gina is someone I have interviewed over the years and admired both in her diverse movie roles and for the incredible activist and leadership she's taken on, fighting for gender equity in Hollywood. But Gina is one of those clever stars that hasn't revealed all that much of herself. Until now.
I never have been in this position of having written something and people are going to read about me and, you know, did I say too much or something?
Let's talk about the title of Dying of Politeness, because you tell a story in the book which kind of, in a weird way, set you out on this path of kind of, I guess, squashing your emotions in some ways. Yeah. Tell that story. You were just, what, 3 years old and you were in church?
Oh, yeah. No, I was a baby. And I don't personally remember it, but I was told about it relentlessly. I was sitting in my mom's lap in church, and I was a baby, and obviously able to sit up at this point, and I was moving around, of course, like babies will. And somehow or other, I lurched forward, and I clocked my head on the pew in front, and it made a huge crack. And the minister stopped speaking, and everybody paused to see, you know, is bloody murder going to be screamed now? And my mom said, she loved to tell this story. My mom said, she clutched me and said, shh, 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 shh. And she didn't say a peep. And that was the proudest thing she could think of, and loved to tell about that. And it was only late, and I heard it so many times, but only later that I started to realize, is that a good thing? I mean, you know, I was able to know that I had to not show my feelings, my real feelings, at a very, very early age. You know, that don't be trouble to anybody. Don't make a noise.
You were basically being praised for repressing your emotions, even if that meant pain. And I'm wondering how that manifested itself in your life from that moment on. In other words, you know, kids should be seen and not heard, and especially for girls to be expressive or to talk openly about things. Was that really discouraged in your home growing up?
Well, I'll tell you, it wasn't about being a girl, because my father actually treated me unusually, I think, maybe for the time, and beautifully. You know, he encouraged my confidence from the very beginning. And, you know, if he was going to shingle the roof, I was too. And
you describe your childhood as sort of like Little House on the Prairie.
Yes, without the pinafores.
Yeah.
Or the prairie. But but it was, you know, it was like a throwback to another century. We always had kerosene lanterns ready, for example. But it wasn't about being a girl. It was about being self-effacing. I don't need anything. I don't want anything. To be incredibly, incredibly polite, not to have anyone have to put anything out for you. And so it was to the point where if someone was trying to hand me a candy, it was no trouble. They already had it in their hand. I had to say, no, thank you. I'm not hungry. Because it was not polite to actually want something or need something. So that was the message.
So to not express your needs, basically. Right. And I guess I got mixed up with the church story. It was when you were 3 years old that you decided, in fact, announced you were going to be an actress.
Yes. I announced to my parents that was going to be my job. I don't even know how I knew people had jobs at 3 years old. And I certainly hadn't been to the movies unless they took us to some animated Disney movie or something. But that's what I said. I'm going to be, I must have seen, some, you know, I know I watch television. I have photos of me watching television. But I somehow perceived that people were pretending to do things, and I wanted to do that.
And obviously, you had to have a lot of confidence, and that expressed your needs. So your parents did give you confidence. So what's the difference of expressing your wants versus expressing your ambition?
Well, you know, something you just said made me think, maybe somehow I had figured out or unconsciously realized that if I was a character, the character wouldn't have to repress her feelings. I can't, we'd need a psychologist to figure this out. But the thing is, I knew I wanted to be on film. I didn't want to be in theater. Like I didn't, there was nothing about me that craved people looking at me. I'm sure that I craved approval, you know, as big approval as I could possibly get. But I think it was the opportunity to try on different personas, to be somebody else, to be somebody who's not quiet and shy and, you know.
Your childhood was really idyllic, but you do write about a neighbor, Mr. Teller, who molested you, basically, Gina, which yeah. made me think, gosh, it's just so commonplace for this to happen. Yeah. And it was a really interesting story because he went from sort of hugging you to touching you inappropriately to mm-hmm. the point you kind of basically showed your mom what he was doing. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to know sort of for you to explain what her reaction was to that.
Right, right. Well, the thing is, I was 10 and I didn't know, I'd never heard the term privates. I didn't even know there was anything between my legs that meant anything that was significant. And so when he started touching me there, I didn't think anything about, I mean, I didn't think this is terribly wrong. This shouldn't be happening. I know, you know, nobody should be touching that area. And so when I told my mom about it, I just showed her on her what he was doing to me. And she went through the ceiling and sailed down the middle of the road to his house. I came out to the sidewalk and watched her disappear into his house. And then when she came back, she said, you're never to bring the paper inside his house again. You leave it down at the bottom of the stairs. Okay. But didn't say, because what happened was not your fault or whatever. So then I knew there are horrible secrets in the world that you're just going to stumble on and not know what they are. And it could be you doing something really wrong, you know, but I just didn't know.
And what did you think about your mom's reaction? And what would you have done if this had happened to your daughter?
Well, right. I mean, right. I think my mom had a great reaction. She, you know, she was very angry. She flew up the street. She confronted him immediately, told him what's what, this is what's going to happen. And that all was great. You know, I probably wish that she would have explained to me what happened or why that was wrong or what I should do in the future or, you know, tell me immediately if anybody touches X, Y, and Z, and all that. But yeah, I would have got the police involved, and you know, immediately. And but it's just a different time now.
I was going to say, I think our vocabulary and our understanding of these situations just they weren't fully formed back then. I remember my sister walking up the street and some man called her over to the car, and I think she was 12 and exposed himself to her. And I think, you know, I don't think my mom was really upset about it. I don't think she called the police, but I think, you know, it was sort of just like, there are a lot of perverts out there and people weren't necessarily held to account when they behaved a certain way, as they are now.
Right, right. Yeah. Do you remember if your mom said, don't approach a car if they call you over or anything like that?
Oh, yeah.
She did. She said that.
Yeah, I think she did. And don't talk to strangers and all that stuff.
Yeah. We always do that now. You know, you start from the beginning. Nobody gets to touch you if you don't want them to, and all that stuff. So it's very different.
You grew up in Wareham, am I pronouncing it correctly?
That's right.
Massachusetts. Yeah. And then after college, you decided that you were going to New York to pursue a modeling career. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you're very tall. How tall are you, Gina?
6 feet.
6 feet. So did you really saw modeling as a vehicle to get into the movie business or to become an actress, right?
Well, yes, this was my scheme because I knew this. I was a theater major, and most everybody wanted to do theater, but I knew I wanted to do films or TV or something like that, be on screen. But nobody ever I never asked anybody. Nobody ever said, you know, if you want to do that, you should actually go to LA instead. Everybody was going to New York, so I went with them. And then I'm like, how am I going to get in movies? But I planned this actually when I was still in college, that I saw that Christie Brinkley and Lauren Hutton and some other, you know,
right,
supermodels were getting cast in movies. And I thought, okay, so the way I'll do this is I will become a model and then they'll just hire me. Because obviously I thought it's so much easier to become a supermodel than an actor. So, but it actually worked out.
Well, talk about how you made the leap.
Right, right. And I never became a supermodel, by the way. I was only on the cover of New Jersey Monthly. So I didn't take off in that way. But they were casting Tootsie in New York, shooting in New York, and had the idea, let's call model agencies to see if they have any models who can also act, because it called for the character to be physically attractive, let's say. And so they said, yeah, we have one, and sent me for the audition. And it was just a, you know, a casting assistant with a video camera and some, you know, office. And they said, wear a bathing suit under your clothes, because if you audition well, they are going to want to see you in a bathing suit. And because the character called for being in her underwear at certain points of the movie.
Right.
So I went to the audition. I read for it. She didn't say, let's see you in your bathing suit. So I just completely forgot. And what are the odds I'm going to get a cast in a movie with Dustin Hoffman as my first audition, you know? So I forgot all about it. And I was going to Paris to do the collections, the runway shows for the first time. I was all excited about that. And I was there. And evidently, Sidney Pollack, the director, saw my video and said, hey, I like her. Where's her bathing suit? Oh, we forgot to get any pictures of her in a bit. Well, get her back. No, she's in Europe. Well, do they have it? Does her agent have any pictures of her in a bathing suit? And fortunately, I had been in a Victoria's Secret catalog. So they sent hot dog. They sent those photos over where, you know, windblown, airbrushed, perfectly lit, you know, instead of standing in a sad, you know, midtown office.
Yeah.
Anyway, I got the part.
Which is pretty amazing. I mean, what was that experience like working with Dustin Hoffman and Jessica Lange and just that incredible cast? And also, Who did I love also in that movie who has MS? She's blonde.
Terry Garr,
who was such a great comedic actress. So, I mean, were you pinching yourself being with all these people?
Oh, I totally was. I couldn't believe it. Although I sort of did believe it because it's what I thought was going to happen. So it's very, it was a very strange time. But, and Sidney Pollack, this incredible director, you know, for my first job, you know, you couldn't ask for anything better. I would have done anything. It was amazing, amazing, amazing. And the funny thing about it was, you know, it's my first, I never been on a movie set. I didn't know anything, but I was too embarrassed about that to ask anybody anything about how things go on a movie set. So I didn't ever ask anything. And people didn't tell me things either. They didn't volunteer, for example, that you only come on the days when you're in a scene. So I assumed everybody was going to come every day, all day. And so I did. And then nobody ever said, by the way, you know,
you don't have to be here.
Yeah. Nobody ever said anything about it. Every day I got my chair and put it right next to Sidney Pollack and sat next to him all day. And it never occurred to me that, wait, the other actors are sitting over there and probably I shouldn't be bothering the director while we're shooting. But
he let you sit next to him and watch him work, which must have been invaluable.
Invaluable. And he never said a thing. He called me Sunshine and was very respectful from the beginning, very respectful. And so, you know, I had this incredible experience that I never would have if I'd asked a question here and there.
You write about the fact that Dustin Hoffman gave you some good advice about how to deal with lecherous men on the set. And what did he tell you?
So all day long, he was giving me advice because he was sure that I was going to have this career. And so one time he said, now, never sleep with your co-star, by the way. You should never do that. It's just, it messes things up. Don't do it. So here's what you say if your co-star propositions you. You say, oh, thank you. You're very attractive. I would love to, but I don't want to ruin the sexual tension between us. And I was like, okay. So I squirreled that away.
And you used it later with Jack Nicholson. And what happened?
On Jack Nicholson. It's too long to explain why this happened, but Jack Nicholson called me after Tootsie and said, and I had got this message, call back Jack Nicholson. Oh my God, incredible. So Mr. Nicholson, hello, this is Gina Davis, the model. And he said, hey, Gina, when's it gonna happen? And I was like, oh my God. But I instantly knew, well, first of all, I should have, you know, what is it going to be about? It's going to be about that. But I said, I know what to say. Oh my God. For once in my life, I know exactly what to say. And I said, well, Mr. Nicholson, Jack, I have a feeling that we are going to be working together someday. And I would hate to have ruined the sexual tension between us.
What did he say?
He said, oh, man, who told you to say that? Because he just somehow knew that someone had told me to say that. But it got me out of the situation.
When we come back, Thelma, Louise, and a life-changing friendship with Susan Sarandon.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, it's Katie Couric, and I want to tell you about one of my new favorite podcasts. It's called A Really Good Cry with the amazing Roddy Devlukia, a plant-based chef, entrepreneur, and now a podcast host who will guide you through a journey of self-discovery, one tear at a time. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Roddy Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You obviously have been in some iconic films. A League of Their Own is a close second, but the most iconic one is obviously Thelma and Louise. Tell me a little bit about that experience and that moment in time, Gina, because I really see your life and career juxtaposed against sort of the feminist movement writ large. And I'm curious why that movie made such a huge impression on the national psyche, if you will.
Well, you know, the reaction when it came up, because none of us predicted that it was even going to be seen or successful. You know, it seemed like a small budget movie and maybe people won't like the ending or something, but it exploded on the scene, you know, cover of Time magazine almost instantly and all that. And the heading was on the title on the cover of the magazine was Why Thelma and Louise Strikes a Nerve. Not why people like it or anything. And there were two negative essays in that issue about how this was a horrible development because we're showing that women have to resort to violence and whatever. The big thing that I noticed was the difference in if people recognized me once the movie came out, because I was used to people saying, oh, I like The Fly, or I like Beetlejuice or whatever, and being, you know, very nice. And that's all they needed was to tell me that. And suddenly people were saying, oh my God, I have to tell you what this movie meant to me. This changed my life. This is how many times I saw it. This is who I saw it with. And, you know, they really wanted to share with me how important the experience was. And I realized that in a profound way that we give women so few opportunities to come out of a movie feeling inspired and empowered by the female characters.
Where are you going?
Fresno.
We've been seeing you all over the place. Why don't you take off those shades? I want to see your eyes.
Yeah, I've been seeing you too.
Yeah, we think you have really bad manners.
Yeah.
Yeah, where do you get off behaving like that with women you don't even know? Huh? Huh? How'd you feel if somebody did that to your mother? Or your sister? Or your wife?
Huh? What are you talking about?
You know good and damn well what I'm talking about. I mean, really? That business with your tongue? What is that? That is disgusting. And oh my God, that other shit appointed.
But it really did strike a nerve. There was definitely a segment of the population who thought it was a very bad thing. Actually, Entertainment Weekly made a chart. They thought that was funny, you know, that people were saying it's so violent. And they made a chart comparing Thelma and Louise and Lethal Weapon. So just look at two violent movies and compare. And it was like the Thelma and Louise number of bullets fired, something like 7. And for Lethal Weapon, they said, well, it's approximately 350, but you can't really single out machine gun bullets successfully. And I mean, it was just the carnage. deaths, 3, including themselves, you know. So anyway,
it just, you know, I think that it did have these incredibly strong female leads in you and Susan Sarandon, and talk about women with finding themselves and claiming agency, right? And I think it was such a powerful message for for women everywhere that you were taking control of your right. destiny, basically, right. to the very end. Right. And you also became lifelong friends with Susan Sarandon, who was sort of the total antithesis of dying of politeness. And what did you learn from watching Susan and the way she moved in the world that you kind of absorbed and took with you, Gina?
Yeah, it was, you know, I think she affected my life, changed my life more than anyone else has. And it was watching the way she moved through the world. I mean, it was from, you know, a few minutes into having met her, I knew what she was. I saw what she was like, and I was like, "How have I never been exposed to a woman who lives like this? Who doesn't start everything she says with, I don't know what you'll think. This is probably a bad idea, but what would you think if? I mean, if you don't like it, we don't have to, you know." Which is the only way. It was the only way I existed, was talking like that, and we were going through the script. Right, the first day I met her with Ridley Scott, and I swear it was like on page one that she said, "You know, my first line here. I think we should just cut it." And I was like, "Well, but that's how we're starting." And I looked at Ridley, and he was like, "Yeah, sure, why not? No, we don't need that." It sounds crazy, but you know, I had never experienced a woman who talks like that, nor seen a reaction like Ridley's, where he doesn't think, hey, how dare you just say things?
Did you find that empowering for yourself when it came to your work and your future roles, that you could use your voice and you didn't have to be so polite?
Yeah, it really, really impacted my life tremendously. Now, I can't say I just jumped to that. Now
right.
that I have voices, I'm going to be that. But I feel like the goal of my life became to be able to react to something or behave in the way I really wanted to, in the way I really felt, instead of massaging everything into what will the other person think, or can I get away with this, or how can I twist this around to be unobjectionable, you know? That's like became my life's goal, and that's what I'm still working on and getting much, much better thanks to that early education.
After the break, how Gina took control of her career after 40.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everyone, it's Katie Couric, and I want to tell you about one of my new favorite podcasts. It's called A Really Good Cry with the amazing Roddy Devlukia, a plant-based chef, entrepreneur, and now a podcast host who will guide you through a journey of self-discovery, one tear at a time. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Roddy Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. I have to ask you about when your career stalled. And it was sort of, you were 40 years old. And gosh, I think it would be so hard to be an actor, Gina, and just worry all the time. And are you in? Are you out? Are you up? Are you down? What's next? You know, what's in the future? And I'm curious if that period of your life was difficult to process and also to deal with.
Right. Well, yes. I mean, I had heard about this phenomenon that supposedly happened, that when you get to 40, for women, the jobs start to fall away. But first of all, I thought Meryl Streep and Jessica Lange and those people were going to fix it before I got to 40. And failing that, I would be the exception. But then it turned out that I was profoundly not the exception. And, you know, I point out in the book that it pretty much happened to all my peers, and it just happens to everybody mostly. It really is a true phenomenon that happens. And so I was shocked by that. And I had always taken time to, I was very picky always about what I wanted to say yes to, and partly because I had played such incredible roles. So I was happy to wait a year until the next good thing came along, but to suddenly have to wait a year, 2 years, 3 years for the next good thing to come along was stunning.
Do you think that that is still the case in Hollywood, Gina? Or do you think, have you seen that situation improve at all?
No, I haven't. In fact, some of our research at my institute showed that 20% of characters in films are 50 or over. And of that, only 5% of characters 50 and over are women. So it's happening. It's full on still there.
So Meryl Streep and actresses like that are clearly the exception, not the rule.
Right. I talked to when I was first starting my institute, someone recommended that I speak to a media personality and tell her about it, and maybe she'll want to cover it. And I got in touch with her, and I explained that there were far fewer female characters. Where right then I was analyzing television shows and movies made for kids, and I said there's far fewer female characters in movies made for kids. And she said, no, that's not true. There's Meryl Streep works all the time. And I was like, well, is she in kids' TV? And plus, what does that have to do with anything? I'm talking about data. But anyway, yeah, it was pretty shocking, all that.
And you did start the Institute. But before you did that, in your 40s, that's when you decided you wanted to have children, and you became... you got into archery and almost made the Olympic team, right? I mean, where did that come from?
It happened that I had to learn some skills that I didn't have in real life for movies. Like the first one was learning baseball for League of Their Own. And that's when I found out for the first time at 35 that I was physically coordinated and athletic, actually. And it was so stunning that... it really changed the way I thought about myself and my body. And then, you know, Cutthroat Island, I'm learning sword fighting. And then Long Kiss Goodnight, I'm learning taekwondo and ice skating and all this other stuff. And so then I decided I wanted to see if I could take up a sport in real life and do well at it, not just a movie version of whatever it was. And saw archery on TV and thought, oh, that is so beautiful. I wonder if I could be good at that. And I take everything too far. So, you know, I became obsessed. And then I made it to the Olympic trials 2.5 years later.
And that's unbelievable. But getting back to this disappointment at roles drying up when you were 40 really ignited this curiosity in you about women and how they're portrayed in media. And I remember it was watching cartoons with your daughter, I believe, that spurred you on to want to change things. Can you tell that story?
Yes, it wasn't roles drying up at all, really, that spurred me on to want to create a research institute. It was my daughter. When she was a toddler, I decided, hey, I'll show her some preschool shows. You know, great idea. That'll be fun. And I have her sitting on my lap. And the very first thing we watched, within 5 minutes or 10 minutes, I was like, wait, how many female characters are on this show? And it was one, and with lots of other male characters. And I thought, wait a minute. And then I saw it everywhere in movies and TV and videos and everything for kids. And seeing it through her eyes made me realize, wait a minute, we are teaching kids to have gender bias from minute one by showing them imbalanced worlds where boys are more plentiful and do most of the interesting things. And there's one girl, you know, usually. And so I didn't intend to take it to the extremes that I have, but I couldn't find anybody in Hollywood who noticed what I noticed. Every single person I talked to said, that's not true anymore. No, that's been fixed.
And Meryl Streep is still working.
Yeah, Meryl Streep's still working. And also, they would name a movie with one female character as proof that gender inequality had been fixed. So I thought, okay, so this is completely unconscious. And if I get the data, I could take it directly to them because I kind of could get meetings with people and tell them something they don't know. And because they make stuff for kids, they must love kids. So this could actually change things. And it happens, it worked.
I mean, I'm so impressed by your commitment to this, Gina, because this wasn't something that you sort of dabbled in. I mean, you have been focused on this for a very long time, and you have taken a very research-oriented approach, a very data-driven approach by working with USC and by really providing the information and the evidence of gender bias. So executives and people couldn't really come up with an excuse for why they were doing certain things. Just give our listeners a bit of insight into some of the things you did and have done in terms of showing how few speaking parts there are for women, how few women-centric roles there are. And will you just kind of tell us briefly some of the work you did and some of the changes that were implemented because of your work?
Right. Well, part of my approach to this from the beginning was I'm going to go privately to, because this is unconscious, there's no point in busting them.
You didn't want to shame anyone.
And there's no reason to get the public involved even. You know, I mean, the other way to go might have been educate the populace and have them demand whatever. But I thought, I know I can go in private to them. And just like nobody even has to know that I'm doing it. So the research from the beginning was numbers and quantity and quality. So we always looked at the occupations, the aspirations, and those kinds of things of the characters. And we also looked at, from the beginning, looked at people of color as well and presented it to them. And people sometimes ask me, you know, did anybody have resistance? And never. We always, people were so shocked because they were so sure they were doing right by girls. They're so shocked and want to do better and have. I mean, we've made tremendous strides, but now we have six categories of underrepresentation that we look at: women and people of color and people over 50, people with large body types, people with disabilities, LGBTQIA, and so we look at all of it, as well as what are their occupations, what are their goals, what are their aspirations. So we can give a very complete picture to people when they want to know, you know, about their project.
And how have you affected change? Because I want you to brag for a minute about how this behind the scenes kind of quiet work you've done has really made a difference. And what I always admire about you, Gina, is you did this before it was kind of, I don't want to say cool, but before more people were kind of jumping into this. And I want to say jumping on the bandwagon because it's such an important bandwagon to jump on. But before people were really interested in these issues, you were in there fighting the good fight. And you did make some progress.
Yes.
I mean, significant progress. So brag for a minute about what people did when you pointed out these things.
Yeah, well, so 2 years ago, we did an update on our research for children's television shows. In other words, shows made for kids, 11 and under, and found that for the first time ever, we have reached gender parity in the lead characters. Equal male and female, it was so different from what it was when we began. And then last year, we updated our family film research and found that the same thing had happened in family films, that now we'd reached parity between male and female lead characters, which was, you know, also incredibly different. And then we now have found out that in children's TV shows, the world that is the fictitious world that is created is now 50-50 also, which is, you know, has never happened. So, I mean, those are some of our biggest goals. And I'm talking about gender.
Right. And and what about behind the camera, you know, female directors? It seems that doors are opening much more frequently, but not enough for female directors. And right. Do you see some changes in that department, as not only as a result of your work, but as a result of, I think, a much greater awareness of this issue just uniformly?
Right, right. Well, it's certainly a big change that women are directing some very big budget movies. That's different. I mean, I think Penny Marshall with League of Their Own directed the highest grossing movie for a female director. But that's different. But really, the numbers have not moved that much. And the reason is, I think, because it's conscious bias. People have known within the industry, people have known for decades exactly what the numbers are. So giving them the research will not make them say, What? I had no idea I wasn't hiring female directors. Let me now change everything. That it wouldn't work because everybody already knew. So it had to be, you couldn't use the technique that I had because it wasn't necessarily unconscious, I think. But things are definitely improving. Disney has really done an incredible job of not only making more movies than anybody else starring a female character, but encouraging and developing female directors. But it is, you're right, it is getting better, but it's not anywhere near even remotely getting close to equal. Yeah.
Speaking of A League of Their Own, did you see the remake on Amazon?
Well, yes. I don't know. I don't think you can call it a remake. Maybe it's a rethink or something.
Yeah.
But this year is the 30th anniversary of League of Their Own, and now there's this series. There's still the Peaches, but they're not our characters. They're some different characters. And from what I've read about the motivation for this was Penny Marshall. At that time was different. And also Penny said, I don't have enough real estate to cover these topics. There weren't any gay characters in the original movie. There was one very short moment that looked at Black women not being allowed to be on the teams, and they really wanted to explore those aspects of it in a much bigger way
and a much more modern way, really.
Much more modern way, yeah. But telling the story through, you know, this period piece. Yeah.
Did you watch it?
I've seen the first three episodes.
And,
yeah.
And what did you think? Was it a strange experience for you to watch it, or really fascinating?
It was strange and fascinating. It was because it's like, this looks so much like what we did. They really captured, you know, the era again. And there's all these, I forget what they're called, but little nods to the original film, you know, like the lead character in the TV show is also a catcher. She's not like my character at all, but she's also a catcher. And she runs for the train to get, you know, to go to Wrigley Field. And one of the characters catches a ball barehanded.
Right.
So there's nods, I guess, to the original film.
Meanwhile, in addition to this book, you've got an exciting thing happening on screen because Zoe Kravitz, her directorial debut is called Pussy Island. And you are in that film, right? So tell me about that and how that came to be.
I got, the request, would I like to be in this movie? And I loved the script. I was so shocked by the title. I shouldn't be, but I'm shocked that people just say it. You know, I think 10 years ago, people would have put P, asterisk, 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 Y, or whatever. But I love the script, and I really loved the character because I get to be quite funny in this role. I play Channing Tatum's assistant, and for various reasons, he needs an assistant, and I am the worst assistant ever. I fall in the pool, I'm dropping things, I can't keep things straight, and it's all funny, but then later you find out why I'm like that. So it's not just that I am like that. Anyway.
Is it a thriller? Is it a comedy? What is it?
A thriller.
Well, that's exciting. And what else are you up to in addition to being in P Island and writing your book? Anything else on the horizon?
No, not in the immediate future. I have to be very careful what I get interested in, because whatever it is, I will want to go to the Olympics in it. So I'm, carefully choosing what I next get involved in. But I'm, developing some other movies and TV shows and things like that.
Yeah, well, I love every time I see you on the screen, big or small. And Gina, I'm, as I said a few times already, it's so wonderful, the work you've done promoting women and other kind of marginalized people and making sure that they have, that they're front and center, because you and I have talked about it many times, how critically important representation is for society and for kind of unleashing the ambitions of everyone who's watching, because, seeing what is possible on the screen really does translate, I think, into people's everyday lives.
It really does. You need to see yourself reflected in the popular culture. I mean, that's where you get information about what's important. And if you don't see somebody like yourself, you're like, okay, I get it. I guess I'm not important to anybody. And so it's very important to change that. Yes.
Gina Davis's memoir is called Dying of Politeness, and it's out now. Next Question with Katie Couric is a production of iHeartMedia and Katie Couric Media. The executive producers are me, Katie Couric, and Courtney Litz. The supervising producer is Lauren Hansen. Associate producers, Derek Clements and Adriana Fazio. The show is edited and mixed by Derek Clements. For more information about today's episode or to sign up for my morning newsletter, Wake Up Call, go to katiecouric.com. You can also find me at Katie Couric on Instagram and all my social media channels. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Hey everyone, it's Katie Couric, and I want to tell you about one of my new favorite podcasts. It's called A Really Good Cry with the amazing Roddy Devlukia, a plant-based chef, entrepreneur, and now a podcast host who will guide you through a journey of self-discovery, one tier at a time. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Roddy Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.